Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Aisha Khalid.
More and more dads in the United States are deciding to stay at home with their children. We'll meet some.
I'd rather be here stress-free, well, relatively stress-free, taking care of them and watching them develop than being in the office.
How can we eliminate tuberculosis in developing countries?
We need an extra coordination of all the areas, all the compartments of this TB control elimination program. And those are 8 main areas.
Mosquitoes can smell malaria, but how will knowing that help fight the disease?
Some people in Tennessee are using guided discussions with seniors to overcome depression.
And we'll meet some folks who have lived more than 100 years.
That's all coming up on this Wednesday's edition of Now.
Aisha, first, welcome back. A couple of weeks off.
Thank you, David. Glad to have you back with us. Thank you.
Now, you work and your husband works.
Yes.
Is finding daycare a challenge for you folks? Is it tough?
I would say finding just any daycare is not, but finding the one that suits your needs and preferences certainly is challenging. One of the very important things that you need to check are the timings and distance of the daycare, by the way. From work or home, again, whichever you prefer. If both parents are working, then it gets more challenging, since the daycare timings and distance must allow for them to pick and drop the child on time.
Oh, yeah, just in case something goes wrong during the workday.
Yeah,
see, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. I used to take the commuter train, and there's this emergency thing where if something went wrong with your child, they would actually drive you home.
Wow, yeah. that must be helpful.
Yeah, that was very helpful. But, you know, sometimes, whether because of the economy or possibly because of personal choice, more and more fathers are staying home with the kids.
Olivia Reed caught up with some of these men who are assuming the role of caregiver and parent.
From peanut butter to playtime.
Hey, Eric!
Yeah, look at that!
It's just another day at work for Jonathan Heisey Grove. Heisey Grove is a stay-at-home dad in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of Washington. He cares for 6-year-old Egan and 18-month-old Zane while his wife goes to the office.
We all hop in the car together as a family and go to the train station so she can say her kisses goodbye and hugs, and then she's off for her day, and Zane, Egan, and I are off for our day.
Days they have been spending together since Jonathan lost his job doing graphic design 2 years ago. A setback he now says was the best thing for his family.
I'd rather be here stress-free, well, relatively stress-free, taking care of them and watching them develop than being in the office.
And Jonathan is not alone. The number of stay-at-home dads in the U.S. has doubled since 1989 to more than 2 million. And Gretchen Livingston, a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center, says that number is only going to grow.
Even in the last 25 years, we've seen changes as far as dads taking on more caregiving responsibilities and also moms taking on more breadwinner responsibilities. The number of hours a day that dads spend caring for their kids has tripled in the past decades. That's a huge change.
The survey finds the reasons more fathers are staying home include disability or illness and inability to find a job. Other fathers stay home simply to care for their families. Heisey Grove says it's also a sign of changing times.
This is just another aspect of that part of American culture where we're saying, you know what, it's okay for the dad to stay home and the mom to work. It's okay for there to be two dads at home. It's okay to have two moms at home. That is starting to change culturally.
Books, books, books.
And that change is books. Redefining the image of the traditional American family. Olivia Reed for VOA News.
That's right.
Now, I know some single dads, but they're not necessarily stay-at-home dads. They still have to put their children in daycare. But you were telling me that one of your neighbors is a stay-at-home dad?
Yes, and his wife works for the federal government, U.S. federal government, and he's a stay-home dad. And I would say that their children are the healthiest in the neighborhood.
Really?
And they are the most well-behaved children in the whole neighborhood.
Well, see, that's because they know that dad's there. It used to be wait till your father gets home, but dad's home now, son.
I think that...
Did you throw that rock through the window?
I think that fact, I've never seen the dad yelling at them, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Fa-la-la-la.
And he's a Yale graduate, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
Went to Yale. He's a stay-at-home dad.
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah, he graduated in maths.
Is he independently wealthy, or is he just can't find a job?
I don't know. I think it was their, you know, mutual decision.
Wow.
Because wife has a good job.
Yeah.
But, you know, who would not like some extra bucks? But
yeah,
they have three kids. They have three kids.
Three.
And all three kids are going to public school, not to the private school.
Right.
But I think it was for the sake of better upbringing of the children.
Wow.
And I think we can see the results. Hmm. As I told you, they are the most well-behaved children in the neighborhood.
Okay. Well, so what about you? Are you a stay-at-home dad?
Let us know your story by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can also post your comments on Twitter at NowVOAShow. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that nearly one-third of the world's population is infected with tuberculosis.
Of that number, the CDC says that in 2012, there were 1.3 million TB-related deaths worldwide.
But there's a new effort to eradicate the disease in more than 30 countries.
VOA's Jessica Berman found out how public health officials plan to fight this battle.
Fewer than 100 TB cases per million people are reported each year in 33 countries and territories, including Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, Malta, and the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Still, that translates to 155,000 new infections and some 10,000 deaths. The new framework, driving down the tuberculosis rate to fewer than 10 new cases per million annually by 2035, was outlined this week in Rome. International public health officials are meeting there to coordinate TB elimination efforts. The ultimate goal is eradication of the disease in those countries by 2050. The WHO defines elimination as less than one new case per million people each year. Giovanni Battista Migliori is head of the European Respiratory Society and director of the WHO Collaborating Center for Tuberculosis and Lung Diseases.
We need an extra coordination of all the areas, all the compartments of this TB control elimination program. And those are eight main areas.
Migliori says the eight key interventions include increased funding to screen for active and silent TB infection in high-risk groups, such as people with HIV, residents of impoverished communities, and migrants from neighboring countries. In addition, he says, the government should invest in research into new tools to rapidly identify and treat tuberculosis, including multidrug-resistant strains. Migliori says there's a strong motivation for low-burden countries to try to eliminate TB.
There are several studies showing that the treatment and prevention of tuberculosis is cost-effective, so that the society costs due to tuberculosis are much higher than the investment needed to prevent them.
Migliori says a renewed push to eliminate TB is needed, so a resurgence of a preventable and treatable disease does not occur in low-burden countries. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
If you would like to comment on this story, please log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Now VOA Show.
And you can always email us at voaasia@voanews.com.
The World Health Organization says that an estimated 627,000 people died worldwide from malaria in 2012.
Most of the new cases were in Africa, where the WHO says one child dies from malaria infection every minute.
Some new research found that malaria infection makes mice smell a bit better to mosquitoes anyway. This raises the odds that they will be bitten and spread the disease.
And as VOA's Steve Barragona tells us, it's the latest example of how parasites manipulate the creatures they infect for their own nefarious aims.
This story begins with squash. Penn State University biologist Mark Mesker has studied a germ called cucumber mosaic virus that infects squash and other plants. And when it does, Mesker says,
we see an elevation in the odors of the plant that we think causes aphids to be more attracted to the host plants.
The aphids pick up the virus when they come to the plant for the advertised meal and carry it to the next plant. Some studies hint that malaria might be doing something similar. When Mesker and his colleagues tested how mosquitoes responded to mice infected with the parasite, they found that sick animals were less attractive to the insects.
But then once the mice recovered, there was a period of several days where the mice became much more attractive to mosquitoes, and they still had high levels of the parasite.
The scientists then collected volatile chemicals wafting off infected and uninfected mice. They let the mosquitoes get a whiff of those chemicals and found that just the scent of an infected mouse had about the same attractive effect as an actual infected mouse. They identified a handful of chemicals in the mouse odor cocktail that were found at higher levels in infected animals than healthy ones. A dab of those chemicals would make even a healthy mouse more appealing to mosquitoes. It's a clever way to help the parasite catch a ride to its next victim, Mesker says.
The malaria parasite is sort of enhancing the odor cues that the mosquitoes are already using to find their host.
And he adds, knowing what those cues are could help find people who are carrying the malaria parasite but don't know it.
It would be nice to have biomarkers that you could use to identify infected individuals who are not actually sick with malaria but or have asymptomatic infections but are still capable of transmitting the disease.
It's a long way off, he added, but it could lead to a portable machine that can sniff out those chemical signatures of infection. Malaria is not the only parasite that tweaks the animal it infects in order to improve the odds for its offspring. A germ called Toxoplasma gondii needs to infect a cat as part of its life cycle. Mice infected with Toxoplasma conveniently lose their fear of cats, notes Peter Hotez, dean of tropical medicine at Baylor College of Medicine.
In the case of Toxoplasma, it doesn't have a mosquito vector like malaria does, so its way it propagates itself is by getting eaten and then infecting the new animal. It's a very innovative story that's emerging in the biology of a host-parasite relationship.
Innovative and perhaps a little creepy. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
To learn more about this story, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And be sure to post your comments on our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
There's an old proverb that says gray hair is a crown of glory that's obtained by a righteous life.
But many Americans place an emphasis on the newest, hottest trend, tech, or gadget.
But at a senior center in Tennessee, some people are using guided conversations to help people overcome depression and loss.
Mike Osborne has their story.
Tell me something that you and HC did together that was just fun and funny at the same time that you remember.
Doug Oliver and his friend Geneva McElroy are talking over old times.
Well, we was on our way to church one time, and I can't think what it was. He told something that my niece was with him. Well, we just both liked to have a fit laughing.
But this is a bit more than a simple stroll down memory lane. Through guided conversation, Oliver helps seniors remember their own self-worth by drawing on the memories of experiences long past.
You knew how to make more out of less.
Well, I tried to.
Is that basically how it seemed?
I guess.
So you didn't have a lot of money in the ministry. They can see what they've done that has or will impact the future, and it lifts their mood. They many times will realize that they are and were important, that they have something to offer.
Oliver says the technique, sometimes called reminiscence therapy, is especially effective with seniors.
One of the hidden benefits that many elders have, even when they are having difficulties with short-term memory is that their long-term memories are usually intact for a much longer time.
Short-term and long-term memories are stored in different areas of the brain. Diseases that impair one may not affect the other. Alzheimer's disease, for example, begins in the areas of the brain where short-term memories are held. Doug Oliver used that quirk of the human brain to help his geriatric patients during the more than two decades he worked as a clinical therapist. Retired now, he continues to use the technique at the Catholic Charities Senior Daycare in Nashville, where he volunteers.
If we were to talk about HC just for a minute, now he passed away 6 months ago, was it?
No, 11, year ago.
Has it been a year? Without already? Trying to lift the depression a little bit, people can languish quickly and deteriorate. And so part of the purpose is to take that healthy part of their thinking and get that firing as passionately as you can.
Oliver says the key is to connect the past to the present and the future, both good experiences and bad, victories and regrets.
Helps them to determine what they learned from those incidences, those memories. How does that apply to them and their families in the present? And what impact do they think they've had on the future?
Catholic Charities couldn't be happier with Oliver's work. Senior daycare coordinator Linda Edwards says he has a gift for helping the elderly feel valued.
I respond readily to his interest in them, his ability to get them to talk about what they remember, what they enjoyed, and the fact that they come away from those interactions feeling good about themselves.
Oliver says just every once in a while he thinks about quitting. He's legally blind as a result of macular degeneration, so getting to the daycare center and home again can be a chore. But Oliver says he has always been drawn to seniors and the stories they tell.
Each time I consider that, I actually step back and say, no, I'm where I need to be right now, and I'm doing what I should be doing.
Oliver says an added benefit to listening to the stories seniors tell is that it brings history alive in a way nothing else can. For VOA News, I'm Mike Osborne in Nashville, Tennessee.
So what about you? Do you try to learn from your elders?
Let us know how your aged relatives have helped you by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can email us your story at voaasia@voanews.com. Speaking of folks in their senior years, one of the fastest growing segments of the U.S. population is made up of centenarians. That's men and women who are at least 100 years old.
A woman in Arkansas who celebrated her 116th birthday recently, July the 4th, is now confirmed as the second oldest person alive in the world today.
There are an estimated 53,000 centenarians in the United States.
VOA's Julie Thibault caught up with three of them to learn what keeps them going.
To Mariana Arden, music is everything.
If I cannot play the piano anymore, I don't want to live.
At 101 years old, the Austrian-born American still plays the piano with the same enthusiasm as she did in her younger years when she performed on stages across America.
I played the songs of the day that were popular and played and sang also some of my old songs.
Today, she plays those same songs, all from memory, for her friends and neighbors once a week at a community center near her home in Maryland. Madeline Brown derives her joy from being around people. She greets everyone she sees in the hallways of the independent living facility where she's been a longtime resident, offering hugs and words of encouragement.
How are you?
Good.
That's the highlight of my life. Make somebody happy.
Brown, who has survived cancer and lived to see 17 presidents, recently celebrated her 100th birthday. She's delighted and proud to have received a personal greeting from President and Mrs. Obama, a special recognition presented to all American centenarians. But as much as she enjoys people, Brown never married.
Why should I marry one man and make him miserable when I could stay single and make them all happy?
But marriage has been good for George Boggess, who, at 102, has been married to Dorothy for more than 70 years.
I don't think I would have lived it, though, without her.
He attributes his longevity to his wife and the values he learned growing up in Texas.
We had to go to church, we had to go to school, and we had to work.
Today, he spends most of his time at a Veterans Medical Center, where he joins in many of the events and activities and cites another important component to his long life.
Attitude. You have to have the right attitude to everything. You can't go around frowning, sad, complaining, criticizing. Attitude.
That attitude helped him survive World War II, and the African Americans' courage earned him a Purple Heart.
It was thought that black soldiers could not live up to expectations of the other soldiers. But we proved during the Battle of the Bulge that that was a false assumption. We stayed and we fought. We won.
These centenarians are part of a fast-growing segment of the U.S. population, says Winnie Rossi, an aging expert at the National Institutes of Health. She was involved in a just-released study that examines why some people live longer than others.
Our goal is to learn from people who have successfully aged and to try to understand the factors that contributed to that so that we can translate those findings into something that can help all of us live healthier longer.
What they've determined so far, she says, is that family history makes a difference.
Researchers have found over time that brothers and sisters of centenarians tend to live long and healthy too compared to their counterparts in the population, as do the children of these very old people.
And that may be the best news yet for the 53,000 American centenarians. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
Do you know anybody who is older than 100?
Only an American.
Only an American?
Only an American.
Really?
Not directly related, but she's the sister of my husband's stepdad.
Okay.
And she can still drive around America, you know, up to New York, Pennsylvania.
Really?
Yes.
She's driving at more than 100 years old.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, she is. And her sons have tried to, you know, steal her key, her car keys from
her, keys,
yeah. But she's still insistent on driving.
Well, you know,
on being independent.
And something else I found out too, I read an article, I believe it was in either Smithsonian or National Geographic. They were talking about centenarians in Peru in the Andes, and one of the things, of course, was diet. Okay, because they don't eat all of the junk food that we have here in the United States. But another one was what they said, having a strong religious faith was very important.
Really?
Yeah. They said a characteristic of all these people that were older than 100 was they had a strong faith. And I asked my therapist about that, and she said, well, or he said, you know, it's called an external locus of control. So if you don't feel like you have to carry the weight of the world, somebody else is going to carry it, then, you know, you live longer.
Yeah, but as mentioned in the story, family history does matter.
Yeah, it does.
Good genes also make a difference.
Good genes make a big difference, but what you do with them, too. I mean, if you have, like in my family, there is a predisposition for heart disease. Okay, my grandmother had a heart attack. My grandfather had a heart attack. But, you know, my grandfather smoked. My grandmother was diabetic and overweight, you know. And so it's kind of like, well, that might be a weakness in your lineage. But if you counteract that weakness by eating right and, you know, exercising and
you're
stuff
right,
like that.
You're right.
Well, you know, if you would like to see video of Julie's story about these people, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And to post your comments, visit our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow. Thanks for joining us for this Wednesday edition of Now.
If you want to see video of the stories on our show, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And if you'd like to hear our show again, visit www.voanews.com/now or we're also on iTunes.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao.
Until Monday, I'm Aisha Khalid.
And I'm David Byrd. Join us again for another edition of Now.